Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something that feels, you know, deceptively simple, but it's actually just this masterpiece of engineering complexity. We're looking at Petflix.
The giant, the undisputed king of cat videos.
The giant, absolutely. The world's largest pet video streaming service. We're talking 200 million subscribers.
And something like 15 million streams all happening at once at peak times. It's massive.
It is. But look, we aren't here to talk about their stock price or, you know, which dog drama just won an award. We are here to talk about one specific moment in time.
Right. We're going to peel back the curtain on all the invisible machinery.
Exactly. So let's set the scene. It's 10 p.m. on a Friday. We're in Karachi, Pakistan. Our protagonist is Fatima.
Okay.
She's a grad student. She's had a long week. Her brain is completely fried. She just wants to relax. So she opens the Petflix app on her phone, and she taps play on a video called Mittens Goes to the Vet.
A true classic.
Yeah.
22 minutes of high drama, meowing, and a carrier.
High stakes stuff. Now, from Fatima's point of view, she taps the screen, and boom, the cat appears. Maybe there's a half-second pause, that little spinning wheel, but it feels instant.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission today is to unpack everything that happens in that tiny gap, because that single tap triggers a journey that goes from global satellites all the way down to the microscopic silicon in her phone.
It's really a tour of a massive distributed system. We're going to trace that single request through, I think, 8 different layers.
Wow.
And what's so fascinating is that at every single layer, there's a different, really hard problem to solve. And it usually involves concurrency, how to handle millions of people all doing this at once without the whole thing, you know, catching fire.
Okay. So let's start at the very top. Layer 1, Fatima taps play. Her phone is in Karachi. Petflix is, well, it's on the internet. But the internet is a big place. How does her phone even know where to send that signal?
So this is the domain name system, or DNS. You can think of it as the phone book of the internet.
Yep.
Fatima's phone knows it wants play.betflix.com, but computers don't really speak in words. They speak in numbers as IP addresses. So her phone sends a query out to a resolver, probably run by her internet service provider, asking, hey, where is this thing?
Right, but this is where I always get a little stuck. I used to think a website just lived at one address. Like, my house has one address. If you want to visit me, you go to that street. But Petflix is global.
Precisely. And that's where the intelligence kicks in.
Yeah.
The query eventually hits Petflix's own authoritative DNS server. And the server isn't just a dumb directory. It does not give the same answer to everyone.
So it's profiling her.
In a way, yeah. It looks at the resolver's IP address, which is a pretty good proxy for her location. It sees she's in Pakistan. Then it looks at its own internal health map of all its data centers around the world. It knows there isn't a huge Petflix data center in Pakistan. But there is one in Singapore.
Okay, so it's sensor to Singapore.
Not blindly. It checks first.
Yeah.
Is Singapore healthy? Is it on fire? Is it overloaded right now?
So it's making a real-time decision based on the current health of the infrastructure.
Yes. In this case, it decides Singapore is the nearest healthy region for South Asia. So it sends Fatima the IP address for the Singapore data center. And she has no idea. But her request has just been routed across the ocean.
Now, I saw something in the notes here, a risk called the zombie data center. That sounds terrifying. What is that?
It's a timing problem. So let's say the Singapore data center suddenly goes dark. Power failure, fiber cut, whatever. Petflix's DNS sees that instantly and stops sending new people there. The next person who asks gets routed to, say, Mumbai or Tokyo.
But what about Fatima?
Well, her phone already has the address for Singapore. Her ISP has cached it or saved it. And this is controlled by something called the TTL, the time to live.
Okay, so if the TTL is like an hour, her phone just keeps trying to talk to the dead data center for an hour?
For an hour, yeah. She just gets an error message. That's the zombie data center. It's dead. But your phone keeps trying to talk to its ghost.
So why not just set the TTL to zero? Just make the phone ask every single time.
That's the trade-off. If you did that, every single click, every image that loads would trigger a brand new lookup. You would basically DDoS your own DNS servers. It's slow, it's expensive. So Petflix keeps those TTLs very short, maybe 30 seconds, to balance the cost against the risk of sending people to a graveyard.
Okay, assuming Singapore is alive and well, we move to layer 2. The request flies across the ocean, arrives at the data center, but it doesn't just walk right in, does it?
No, it is the front door, specifically a fleet of load balancers, and they hand the request off to a service called Petgate.
Petgate. The internal naming conventions are definitely cute. What does it actually do?
It's the API gateway.
Yeah.
Think of it less like a door and more like a bouncer or a concierge at a really busy club. Its job is to handle the chaos.
Right.
First, it authenticates Fatima. Is she actually a subscriber? Is her payment info good?
Right.
And then it has to figure out which internal service she needs. She tapped play, so she needs the playback service.
But it's not just one computer running that playback service, is it?
No, there are thousands of instances of it. And this is where we hit a really crucial safety mechanism, and I think it's misunderstood. The circuit breaker.
Okay, I know this term from my basement electrical panel. If I plug in too many things, the breaker trips so the house doesn't burn down.
It is the exact same principle, just for software. Imagine one of those back-end services starts acting up. Maybe a bad bit of code made it really slow. Yeah. Instead of taking 50 milliseconds to reply, it's now taking 5 seconds.
Wait, hold on. A fire in my house is obviously bad, but on an app, who cares if it takes 5 seconds? Why do you need a breaker for that? Just let it be slow.
Because in a system like this, slow is actually worse than broken. If PetGate just keeps sending requests to that slow service, the connections start piling up. It's a traffic jam. Threads get blocked waiting for an answer. Memory fills up. And very quickly, PetGate itself runs out of resources and crashes. And because PetGate is the front door for everything, the whole region goes down. No one can log in, no one can search, nothing.
So the slow service is like a clog that backs up the entire pipe.
Precisely. So the circuit breaker is watching. PetGate sees the failure rate or the latency for that service has spiked. Let's say 50% of requests are timing out. So it opens a circuit.
It just cuts the wire?
It stops sending any traffic to that failing instance. It just returns an immediate error to the user or maybe a fallback response.
Yeah.
It sacrifices that one feature to save the rest of the platform.
That makes a ton of sense. It's better to have one small error than a total blackout.
And then after a little while, it'll try what's called a half open state. It lets one test request through. If it works, great. It closes the circuit and resumes traffic. If not, it stays open.
Okay, so PetGate let Fatima in. She's authenticated. The circuit is closed. Everything's healthy. Now we get to the actual work, layer 3, the symphony of microservices.
This is the fan out. Fatima tapped one button, but that one request triggers an explosion of activity inside the data center. PetGate doesn't just call one thing. It fires off a bunch of parallel requests to multiple microservices at the same time.
What kind of services are we talking about?
Well, you've got the auth service, obviously, to check her standing. The playback service to find the video file.
Mm-hmm.
But also the recommendation service. It's already calculating what she might want to watch next before this video has even started.
Wow.
And the analytics service, which is logging this event to a message queue so they know what's popular.
And it does all of this at once.
All in parallel. They use a protocol called gRPC, which is way faster than normal web traffic, to fire these off simultaneously.
Yeah.
The total time it takes is based on the slowest service, not the sum of all of them.
But that sounds like a recipe for a massive traffic jam. The notes here mention the thundering herd problem, and that sounds like a stampede.
Oh, it is the absolute nightmare scenario for any systems engineer. Imagine it's Friday night, and Petflix just dropped season 2 of Paws of Fury.
The big prestige drama. Everyone's been waiting for it.
Exactly. And suddenly, 10 million people all hit play within a 30-second window.
10 million in 30 seconds.
Boom! The front door is kicked in. That's 10 million requests hitting off, 10 million hitting playback, 10 million hitting analytics. The system just cannot handle that kind of spike. If it tries to process everything, it will fall over.
So what does it do? It can't just crash.
It uses something called prioritized load shedding. It performs triage, basically. The system is smart enough to know that not all requests are created equal.
Like an ER doctor deciding who to treat first in a disaster.
Exactly like that. What's the most important thing? The user wants to watch the video. So playback requests are code red high priority. Keep those. But that prefetch for the next recommendation, that's nice to have, but it's not critical. So you drop it. Or you send back a generic hashed list of popular movies instead of a personalized one.
And the analytics.
Buffer it. Just save the data and process it later when traffic dies down.
So the system degrades gracefully. You might not get your custom recommendations. The interface might look a little basic for a minute, but the main thing, the video it plays.
Right. It's way better to have a slightly dumber app that works than a super smart app that's just dead.
Okay, so the playback service is doing its job. It needs to get the map of the video files for Mittens Goes to the Vet. And this brings us to layer 4, data and caching.
Right. The playback service needs the video manifest. Now, it doesn't go straight to the hard drive. That's way too slow.
Yeah.
It first checks Petcache, which is an in-memory storage system like Memcache.
Okay.
And since Mittens is a popular video, that manifest is almost certainly sitting right there in RAM, ready to go. That's a cache hit. takes milliseconds.
And how does it find it? If there are thousands of these cache servers, how does it know which one has the right file?
So this is one of the coolest but hardest concepts to grasp, consistent hashing.
Okay, break this down for me. I see the word ring in the notes.
Imagine a giant clock face, a circle. Every piece of data, every movie manifest is assigned a number that puts it somewhere on that clock. So Mittens might be at the 14-minute mark.
Okay, I'm picturing the clock. Where are the servers?
The servers are also placed on that clock face. Let's say we have servers at the 15-minute mark, the 30-minute mark, and the 45-minute mark. To find the data for Mittens, which is at 14, the system just looks at the clock and walks clockwise until it hits a server.
So it walks from 14 to 15. The server at the 15-minute mark has the data.
Exactly. Now, here's the magic. What happens if that server at 15 minutes crashes and goes offline?
Well, the data at 14 minutes, it has to go somewhere else.
Right. It just keeps walking clockwise. It bypasses the dead server and lands on the next available one at 30 minutes.
Oh, I see. But what about all the data at, say, 40 minutes?
That data is completely unaffected. It still walks to the 45-minute server. And that's the genius of it. If you just used a simple list of servers, adding or removing one would reshuffle everything. With the ring, only the immediate neighbors are affected. It stops the whole cache from being wiped out every time a piece of hardware changes.
That is brilliant. It isolates the chaos. But what if the data isn't in the cache at all?
Then it goes to the persistent storage layer, which in this case is Apache Cassandra. This is the heavy-duty database. And this introduces a very specific kind of weirdness called eventual consistency.
The notes have a great example for this, the watch later glitch. I think I've actually had this happen to me.
It's super common. Cassandra copies data all over the world. But the speed of light is finite, you know,
oh.
It takes time. So let's say Fatima adds Pause of Fury to her watch later list on her phone. That writes to the database in Singapore.
Okay, she taps add.
Then literally 1 second later, she picks up her tablet to see if it's there. But maybe for load balancing reasons, her tablet connects to a slightly different database node, a replica that hasn't gotten that update yet.
So the list looks empty on her tablet. She thinks the app is broken, taps add again.
Exactly. That's eventual consistency. It will be consistent eventually, in a few hundred milliseconds, but not instantly. So to fix this, Petflix uses session-level consistency.
Which means
it basically tags her session. The system makes a promise that whatever she writes, she can read immediately. It forces her tablet to check with the specific database node she just wrote to. Other people might not see it yet, but she does.
It's like a personal guarantee. I promise to remember what you just did.
It has to be. Users absolutely hate feeling like their actions didn't save.
Okay, so we have the manifest. The app knows what files it needs to get.
Mm.
Now, layer 5. This was the biggest surprise to me. I think most people assume the video just comes from the cloud. But the video, it's not actually in Singapore, is it?
This is the big twist. If every single chunk of video, we're talking gigabytes of data, had to travel from Singapore to Karachi for every user, the internet would just grind to a halt. The latency would be awful. It would cost a fortune.
Well, where is Mittens?
It's probably down the street. Literally. Petflix uses something they call the Petflix box. It is a physical server, a red storage appliance, about the size of an old VCR that they physically ship to internet service providers.
Wait, they put them in a truck. In 2026...
They put hard drives in a box, put that box in a truck, and they drive it to the ISP's building. There's very likely a Petflix box sitting in a rack physically inside Fatima's ISP in Karachi.
That feels so low-tech for such a high-tech company.
It's shockingly efficient. You should never underestimate the bandwidth of a station wagon full of hard drives.
Huh.
So overnight, Petflix's algorithms predicted that Mittens would be trending in Pakistan. So during off-peak hours, like 4 a.m., they pushed the actual video file to that local box in Karachi.
So they preloaded it.
Exactly. So when Fatima hits play, the video isn't crossing an ocean. It's traveling maybe two hops inside her own city's network.
And that saves the ISP a ton of money on bandwidth. And Fatima gets instant 4K video.
It's a symbiotic relationship. But there is a catch. It's what the notes call the Gerald the Goldfish exception.
Poor Gerald.
Yeah. If Fatima decides to watch some super niche, unpopular video, Gerald the Goldfish, a meditation, that video won't be on the local box. That box only has a few terabytes of space. It only holds the hits.
So Gerald gets evicted to make room for Mittens.
Gerald never even made the cut. So if she watches that, the box says, I don't have it. And it has to go fetch it from a regional exchange or maybe all the way from Singapore.
So Gerald takes a few extra seconds to buffer.
Right. And once it's fetched, the box will then cache it locally just in case someone else in Karachi has the same weird taste in goldfish videos.
There's also some fascinating tech in how the video actually plays on the phone, the adaptive nitrate.
Oh, yeah. The player on her phone is in constant communication with that box. If Fatima walks into an elevator and her cell signal drops, the player detects that bandwidth drop instantly, and it switches seamlessly from, say, 1080p down to 480p.
Does it pause to do that?
No, and that's the trick. The video is sliced into these little four-second chunks. The player basically just says, okay, the next chunk, give it to me in low quality. It happens at the chunk boundary, so it's super smooth. Most people don't even notice.
And the encoding itself is smart, right? Not one size fits all.
No, they use a metric called VMAF. They basically realize that a video of a cat sleeping doesn't need nearly as much data as a video of, like, a dog agility championship.
Because the dog is zooming all over the place.
Exactly. Right. Lots of motion, confetti, flashing lights. That's hard to compress. The cat video is mostly static, so they can compress that file much more without the human eye being able to tell the difference. It saves a massive amount of data.
Okay, let's pivot. We've talked about the big video files in the box, but the brains of the operation, the user data, payments, viewing history, that all still lives in the main data center. Layer 6 takes us into the pod.
Right, so the playback service isn't just one machine, it's a team. It's a replicated group of, say, 5 machines that all act as a single unit.
Why 5? Why not just one powerful one?
Redundancy. But you can't just have 5 bosses all yelling at once. You need 1 leader and 4 followers.
Okay, why the hierarchy?
For consistency. Only the leader is allowed to accept changes or writes. If anyone could write to the database at any time, you'd have chaos. So the leader takes the request, writes it down, and then tells the followers, hey, update your records to match mine.
What happens if the leader dies?
Then they vote. This is the RAF protocol. If the followers stop hearing from the leader, they assume it's dead. They each start a randomized timer. The first one, whose timer runs out, declares itself a candidate and asks the others for their votes.
It's a coup.
It's an election. But here's the crucial math. You need a majority to win. You need 3 out of 5 to agree.
Why is that majority so important?
To prevent split brain. Imagine a network cable gets cut and the group gets separated. You have 2 servers on one side of the cut and 3 on the other.
Okay.
The side with just 2 servers knows it cannot form a majority. 2 out of 5 isn't enough. So they freeze. They stop accepting any changes because they know they might have outdated information.
And the side with 3?
They can form a majority. So they elect a new leader from their group of 3 and they keep working.
So the system basically sacrifices the minority to ensure there is only ever one version of the truth.
Exactly. It prevents 2 different leaders from existing at the same time and just corrupting all the data.
Now, layer 7. We are getting deep into the infrastructure, the Russian nesting dolls.
This is how the data center is actually organized.
Yeah.
At the very bottom, you have the physical server, the metal rack with blinking lights. But Petflix doesn't just run their code on the bare metal. They use something called a hypervisor to slice that server into multiple virtual machines, or VMs.
And then inside the VM?
Inside the VMs, they run containers managed by Kubernetes.
Wait, why so many layers? That seems like a lot of bureaucracy. Why not just run the code on the server?
Isolation. It solves the noisy neighbor problem.
Okay, explain that one.
You have to remember, these servers are often in the cloud. Petflix doesn't own the building. They might be sharing a single physical server with a hospital or a gaming company.
Right.
If Petflix's code has a bug and it crashes the entire operating system kernel, you only want it to crash their VM.
You don't want the hospital's database to go down because someone at Petflix made a mistake.
Precisely. The VM protects the hardware from the operating system, and the container protects the application from other applications. It creates a sandbox. If you break your toy, you don't burn down the whole playground.
We have finally arrived at the very bottom. Layer 8. The hardware, the silicon itself.
The physical reality.
Mm.
That Petflix box in Karachi has a CPU with, let's say, 16 cores, but it's serving 1,000 different video streams at once.
16 brains doing 1,000 tasks. How?
This is the key difference between parallelism and concurrency. At any given nanosecond, only 16 things are actually happening at once. That's parallelism. But the operating system switches between those 1,000 tasks so incredibly fast that it looks like they're all happening at once. That's concurrency.
And this is where things get really dangerous with memory, right? The notes mention race conditions.
Oh, this is a classic nasty bug. Imagine you and I are sharing a notebook. We both have pens. And we both try to write on the exact same line at the exact same instant.
Our hands would collide, the ink would smear, and the result would be unreadable garbage.
That is a race condition. The data gets corrupted because 2 threads tried to modify it at the same time. To prevent this, programmers use locks. It's like I grab the notebook and yell, "I'm writing!" You have to wait until I put the pen down.
But locks create their own problem, don't they? Deadlocks?
Yes. Yeah. That's where I have the notebook and I'm waiting for the pen. But you have the pen and you're waiting for the notebook.
And we both just wait politely forever.
And the stream freezes. Nothing ever moves forward.
And finally, on Fatima's phone itself, there is one last piece of hardware working in overdrive.
The decoder chip. This is really the only part of the entire stack where human perception creates a hard, non-negotiable deadline. The video is 30 frames per second. That means the chip absolutely must produce a new frame every 33 milliseconds.
What happens if it takes 34 milliseconds?
The video stutters. The illusion is broken. It doesn't matter if the DNS was fast, or the cache was a hit, or the routing was perfect. If that little decoder on her phone misses its deadline by just 1 millisecond, Fatima notices.
It's just incredible. We've gone from global routing decisions being made in Singapore to a microscopic deadline on a chip in Karachi.
And we covered everything in between. Load balancers, circuit breakers, caching rings, consensus protocols.
So let's zoom all the way out. Back to the couch. Back to Fatima.
She's just watched the cat. It's meowing. The video is perfectly crisp.
And she has absolutely no idea any of this happened. She probably thinks the video just sort of flew through the air straight to her phone.
And that really is the triumph of good distributed systems engineering. The goal is invisibility. If the engineers do their job right, you never even know they exist.
It really makes you think about resilience. We talked about circuit breakers, about sacrificing the recommendation engine to save the video, about having short TTLs.
The entire system is built on the fundamental assumption that things will break. Hard drives will fail. Network cables will get cut. Code will have bugs.
Right. They don't try to build a perfect machine that never fails. They build a machine that's really, really good at handling imperfection.
Exactly.
You know, maybe there's a life lesson in that. We spend so much time trying to be perfect, trying to prevent any mistakes from ever happening, but maybe the real goal should just be to have a good personal circuit breaker.
Know what really matters? Shed the load that doesn't, and just keep playing the video.
That's a thought to chew on. Thanks for taking this journey through the stack with us.
My pleasure.
And to our listener, next time you tap play, spare thought for the thousands of machines voting, racing, and collaborating, all just to bring you that cat video. We'll see you on the next deep dive.